I've really had fun this week. And what I've had the most fun is talking to you folk at odd times during the week here and there. It's really been exciting for me. Thank you. You have given me inspiration. You have added tales to my treasure. It's been really fun. Tonight what I'd like to do, and it's really been a battle because it's really funny. Today I got three emails trying to tell me to be sure and talk to you about Ben Robb and his apple cart, and I can't do that. So I don't know if one of you is one of those. I'm sorry. That's just not going to work for me today. I received an email along with the others that seem to come to my desk quite often. And the email said, I need your help. And it was from Remnant Publications, from the president of Remnant. And he says, Dick, I've got a project that I want you to help me with. And I read through it. He wanted me to voice one of the characters in Ellen White's audio, in Ellen White's Testimonies to the Church series. You know, I don't know how many, are there 9 books? Or 29? There's a whole bunch. Yeah, okay. And so he had said, this is what I want you to do, and this is how quick I want it. And, well, number one, I didn't want to do it. You ever been asked to do something that you just wanted to say no and walk away? But I'm a pleaser, which is a disease that my wife has been doing her best to vaccinate me against for 43 years. Is it 44 yet? We're in our 44th year now, right? Cool. And I'm not, the vaccine is not taking. So I'm always trying to please people and say yes. But in this case, I just sent back and said, no, I can't do it. I don't have time. And it's not something I would prioritize. Was that a nice way of saying, uh-uh? 2 days later, I get another email. I really need you to do it. You know, what they're doing is they're taking all of those letters in the Testimonies to the Church, and where Brother D or Brother JPL writes back to her, then you've got his voice. Dear Mrs. White, I am really sorry, but I think, you know, or whatever. And so, you know, they're asking me to voice one piece of it. And I, for a couple of reasons, I found that really hard. First of all, I really enjoy Ellen White's writings. I love reading Desire of Ages. I love reading a variety of different books. And I think she saw a lot of the videos and just described what she saw. What a cool job. But I'm not sure if she wrote a letter to you that it's a letter to me. And so I've never been terribly excited about the testimonies. Although, it's kind of cool because a lot of those letters, you know, in the middle of the night she would wake up and the angel would say, write a letter to Dirksen. Tell him that it's really important to wear a tie at least once during the week. Okay, so she'd get up and she'd write that letter. And then she'd toss it in her desk and forget about it. And she would leave it for months. Sometimes 2 years. And then in the middle of the night she'd wake up and say, oh, that letter to Dirksen. And she would get it out and give it to Sarah McInturfer. And in the morning, it'd get mailed. And it would arrive at me exactly on the moment I needed it the most. Now that's pretty impressive. That has to be divine involvement. And so every time I look at the testimonies, I think, But it's never been my favorite set of books. So the second letter comes, and he says, would you please do it? And it's pretty please. And he says, you know, I'll give you a free Bible. And I wrote back, and I said, no thanks. And he was just, no thanks. And about 3 days later, I get another email. And this one is just really pushy. I need you to do it. I need you to, but this is the date. And here is the attachment of all the words I want you to read. And it's 24,326 words or something. Well, that's going to take me a whole afternoon. I don't want to do that. And so I took it into my boss, Don Noble, the president of Maranatha Volunteers. And I said, will you please help me say no to this? And he read my stuff. And he says, I think you ought to do it. I was so ticked. So at that point, I did the divine thing, and I procrastinated. You know, God never delivers on time, so I figured maybe I didn't have to. And then finally, I have no choice. It's due Tuesday morning. They have to have it. And it's Monday. And I get this little, hello, how are you doing? Email. I hate those. And so I called one of the gals, Wendy, in our office, and I said, can you just help me a little bit this afternoon? I need to record some stuff. She said, oh, yeah, sure. So we go in, and I pull up these 24,000 words. It's forever. I didn't print them. I just had them on the, you know, just there on the computer. And I started to read into her microphone. My assignment was to read any time Ellen White quoted the words of Christ in a letter. Well, I'm not Jesus. I know a whole lot of stuff about me that says, that doesn't fit. I'm sorry. And so I have just pushed this away as much as I dare. So I start reading. And I figure I'm just going to read anything that's read in the New Testament and be done with it. And I start going, and I'm finding I'm reading the same thing again and again and again. And after about 10 minutes, I'm angry. And I look at Wendy and I say, can you believe these people? They know about computers. And yet they're making me read the same stuff again and again and again and again. Don't they realize I can just read it once and they can just dupe it again and again and again and again? This is really stupid. And Wendy looked at me and said, just read it. So we went back and started over. After a drink and a prayer, you know, I went up this cold water and came back in and prayed a little bit and came back and said, okay, let's do this. And I started reading and taking notes. And I discovered something that I've got to share with you. It's just too important not to. There are many things she quoted in those letters. But if Ellen White is told by an angel or God himself in the middle of the night or in the middle of the day to write a letter to somebody, and includes a quote from Christ in it, would you think that's a pretty important quote from the Bible? And so I started taking, you know, just putting little check marks, Hasbro, 4/4/, of how many times I'm reading the same verse. And when I was all done, I discovered there were three verses that I really read a lot. One far above all the others. And then the next two pretty much the same. One's a little bit more than the other. And then everything else, there's just a little bit of this and that. You want to know what those are? It'll change the way you think about God. I guarantee it. It's amazing. Okay, the first one, by far the most quoted by Ellen White, above and beyond anything, by just mountains. John chapter 17, verse 20. Now, in chapter 17 of John, begins my little, you know, my Bible has all these little sections with titles. Jesus prays for himself. Jesus prays for his disciples. Jesus prays for the believers. Well, it's the believers part that she quotes. It's not the Jesus prays for himself or the disciples. It's the believers part. And I'm going to read you four verses from the New International. Jesus' words, bright red. Okay? My prayer is not for them alone. Now, this refers to the disciples in the paragraph ahead. My prayer is not just for the disciples. I pray also for those who will believe in me through the message of the disciples. Now, that's me, right? That's you, me, we. That all of them may be one, Father, just as you are in me and I am in you, may they also be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. Those words right there, that's what I read more than anything else. I read it scores of times. That's what she quoted the most in her letters. So let me read it again. It must be important. So my prayer is not just for you, the disciples, but for all of those who will believe what you've said about me. I pray that they may be one. Just as you, Father, are in me and I am in you, may they be in us so that the world may believe that you have sent me. And then if you go down for the next three or four verses, he uses this same metaphor again and again, that we may be one, that they may be one, that we may be all one. And the whole concept of oneness becomes the core of what she quotes from Jesus. So I've spent some time in some of the rest of her books. She talks about this a lot. And the more I thought about it, I think what she's saying by the preponderance of this quote is that this is the issue in God's church. that we may be one, like God is one. But that we can get into that and just be part of His one. That's the one thing God really wants from us. Now, it's interesting because Ron and Pat, for instance, I remember, and Gary, you weren't there. I'm sorry you missed this. It was really cool. When we built the new Glendale Church in Glendale, Arizona, 427 years ago, you may remember the conversations about the carpet. The conversations about the carpet in the new Glendale Church, they wavered between purple and maroon. You would have done yellow, huh? I mean, there were people who said, it needs to be green. And we shut them all up because we really, there was a crowd over here. And it really became, there was a crowd over here that wanted purple. And there was a crowd over here who wanted maroon. Well, I didn't care. Ken Blanton, the pastor, we didn't care. We're not going to be there the rest of our lives. You guys are going to have to walk on it. What color did we do?
Burnt orange shag.
Burnt orange shag. That's like the barf, that's barf carpet. You can barf on it and nobody would know. You know what I remember about that? I remember the anger in the church over the color of the carpet. I mean, really anger. People would sit as far as they could that way to get away from the people who were maroon. I mean, it was just, and I remember Ken looking at me one night and he says, doesn't God talk about oneness somewhere? And I said, and somebody in the congregation, I think it was Doris Starkey, said, yeah, but God's always into blue. And it just, you know, you couldn't go anywhere. It was just awful. Have you ever been in anything like that in a church? I pray, Father, that they can be one as you and I are one. Now, does that mean we'll never argue over carpet colors? No, we're always going to argue over carpet colors. And whether we ought to have hard wooden pews, or whether we ought to have movable chairs, or whether there ought to be a steeple, or a steeple with a cross, or no steeple and no cross. Yeah, we're going to argue over all that kind of stuff. Big deal. But it can't impact our oneness. Okay? It's not going to change where we sit. Because we've got to be one. And the thing that makes us one is Jesus Christ and His promise of salvation. The carpet color is irrelevant. But we managed to make the carpet color the difference between whether or not we go to church. We actually lost members over the color of the carpet. It just makes me cry. And I've seen that happen over so many things. I've heard it happen over drums. No, there are people who have left churches I've been in because we had drums. One year I was doing a job for Global Mission at the General Conference. And my assignment was to put together the Global Mission report for General Conference session in Utrecht. And so I've got crews all over the world pulling in videos and trying to put this thing together. And I sent one crew, David and a couple others, to Burkina Faso. You know where that is? There's four of us, I think. It's in Africa. It's out on the Horn. Totally Muslim country. But we had just established a Seventh-day Adventist church in Burkina Faso. How cool is that? So I sent a crew. And the crew went. They went into the church. It was just really a dingy, dark, little, awful place. And they went in and looked around. And said, there's no light in here at all. We've got to go outside to have church. So they said, okay. And they all went outside to have church. And they brought with them their big African drums. You know the ones that are half a log with two cows stretched across them? And they just are gorgeous. Boom, 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 boom. And boy, it didn't take me long to know what was going on there. And I looked at it and I watched and I said, David, why does the New Adventist Church use drums in Africa? Don't they know that I was raised in San Diego. We couldn't have drums because in Africa, evil people use drums to call the evil spirits. So you can't have them in church, right? And so here's David filming a drums in the Adventist church in Burkina Faso. And I'm saying, something wrong. We can't use this at General Conference. They'll kill us. And he said, no, no, no. I knew you'd ask that question. So I asked them, how come you're using drums? And they said, well, it's the only way we know to really praise God. I said, and he said, so how is your worship different today than it was when you were animists worshiping the demons? And they said, oh, we were using balafons. We can't use balafons. Balafons are evil. They call up the demons. And he said, show me a balafon. So they went down the street and he said, here's the video. And he walks in and what they're using to call the demons is a wooden marimba. A balafon. And I've seen a lot of these now in Africa. So here's my quandary. In San Diego, we couldn't use drums in church because the Africans used them to call up the demons, but we had marimba choirs. Now make sense out of that for me. What I have learned is that a lot of that stuff is culture. It has absolutely nothing to do with God. Nothing at all. But we tend to choose to make it really important. And God says, I want you to be, Father, I would that they could be one as you and I are one. In you, that you and me, I in you, them in us. For when they are one with us, the world will believe that you sent me. My, I've just fallen totally in love with that phrase, with that whole verse, and with the importance Ellen White puts on it. It changed my whole thinking about a lot of things she wrote and why she wrote them. So I've spent a lot of time now in the last year and a half trying to figure where oneness and where brokenness is in the Adventist community. I started asking a question everywhere I go. And if you followed Maranatha Mission Stories at all, you know that we go a lot of weird places. Wherever I find an Adventist leader, after getting to know him a little bit, I say, so why do people become Seventh-day Adventists in your country, in your town, in this community? And I've been listening to their answers. What do you think they say? The answer, consistently, I have three exceptions in a year and a half, is the word truth. We have truth. And so my next question is, what does that look like? To the person who joins the church, what do they find attractive about truth so that they are willing to leave their Muslim background, their animist background, their Catholic background, their whatever background to join the Adventist church because you guys have truth? And I always get the same answer, except for three exceptions. Well, Sabbath. When you're dead, you're dead. And judgment. You better get ready or God will whop you. Full stop. That is the essence of Adventism in many people's minds. Let me do that again. Number one, we have truth. That means we have the right day to worship. We know that when you die, you're dead. And that you better get ready because judgment's coming and God's about to whop off your head. You believe that? So I have listened to this and I've said, why am I hearing this and what's missing? Because the very process of what I've just described destroys oneness. And then one day I'm in the office of the union president in Malawi. Malawi is a huge country. It's the fastest growing Adventist community in Africa. And I sat there with my friend Pastor Mfunye. And I said, so, why do people join the Adventist Church in Malawi? And he looked at me and he said, Dick, do you know what Malamulu means in my language? I said, no, I have no idea. He said, when the early Adventists came to Malawi, they built a medical center. They actually bought a Baptist compound out on in the tea plantations. And they turned it into Malamulu Mission Station. Josephine Cunnington Edwards went there for years. That's where she found Alice Princess. And there's just so many good stories. More than 45% of the medical workers in the country of Malawi graduated from Malamulu. Nurses, x-ray, lab. You know, we've really had an impact with Malamulu. It is the major mission for everybody in the entire country of Malawi. No, what does Malamulu mean? He says Malamulu means Ten Commandments. Every time I hear it, I cringe. Because, Dick, it means that people know us as the people of the Ten Commandments. And I want to be known as the people who love like Jesus loves. Do you see a conflict? As Seventh-day Adventists, we live with this conflict all around the world. Wherever I go, I preach from Ephesians. And all you got to do is spend a few minutes in Ephesians. You know what Ephesians is about. Once in a while, I'll bounce into Romans chapter 12 or go back to John chapter 14, maybe 15. Because they don't know anything about grace. And when they hear about grace, underneath a cashew tree in Mozambique one day, I'm preaching about grace from Ephesians. And all of a sudden, a woman on the second row begins to weep. And then the pastor of their church, who's in the back, begins to weep. And then the guy who's translating just stops. And he begins talking to them in their language, in Rongo. And he says, it's really here. I just read it. I didn't know it was there either. And he goes and he quotes again and again and again about what it means that Jesus Christ says, I accept you because of who I am, not because of what you've done. And the people stand and cheer. And Jesus, when Ellen White is trying to communicate, Dick's, you know, whatever it is, and there's marvelous testimonies, and there's testimonies that make you scratch your head. But the text she quotes the most from the voice of Christ, Father, I would that they could be one. As you and I are one. You and me, I and you, them and us. For when we are one, the world will know you sent me. The only way we finish this work, to use an Adventist euphemism, is to become one with Christ. That's not what you usually think about at all. But I want to say it again. The only way we will help the world see Jesus is to become one with Him. So I want to know how you spend your time. Is our schedule such that becoming one with God is the obvious core of who we are? Is our life such that our neighbors sense something different in that house? It's almost as if God lives there. Is there something going on in your life that makes people believe in Jesus even though you haven't said a word? Because the oneness communicates itself so clearly. Now, for me, those are real questions. And they're so real because everywhere Brenda and I go in the world, we find people who are living exactly that way. Exactly. And, you know, I don't have a lot of time to do illustrations, but I've got to do one that's just so important to me. Of El Shaddai, Chile. El Shaddai is one of the names of God. First time I really heard it described well was right here on this campground. Leslie Harding was preaching, and he was doing a morning series on the names of God. And on Tuesday morning, he did El Shaddai. And using some incredible Greek or Hebrew interpolation, he made it come out to say, the eternal breasted one. I'll never forget that. As a young man, that was important to me. It was just, and he's describing God as the eternal breasted one. And I'm saying, I don't know, Dad, where are you? Can I listen? And what his point is, that phrase describes the feminine nature of God. The one that pulls you close and hugs you and makes it okay. And his whole sermon was about the closer you get to God, he's more like mom. She just brings you in and she loves you whether you're evil or good or anything. And it was just wonderful. A few years later, I was in this area. I was up at actually Holbrook. And we were delivering, we were doing kind of a little mission trip from where I was working in Northern California. And we came down, Brenda and I, along with a group of teenagers, and we went to Holbrook, and on Sabbath of, and now I'm not going to remember his name, it won't matter, Drachenberg, who was working there then, said, "Can I take you someplace really special?" Well, I'm always one for adventure. And so we got in the back of his big black whatever it was, and he started driving out through the reservation, out toward the mountains. And I said, "Where are we going?" He says, "You're going to go someplace white men don't go." And I said, "Okay, can I take my camera?" No. So I don't have any pictures. He took us to the top of Old Oribe on the Hopi Reservation. White men at those point were not allowed up there, but Drachenberg had made such good friends with the Indians because of what he had been doing at Holbrook that he just could go up there any time and meet with the families of his kids. And every once in a while he took a friend, and so Brenda and I went along. And he took us into the home of one of the students from Holbrook. We met a lot of the different Hopis on the road and had some great conversations, went into this little mud house right on the edge of the cliff. You know, the mesa goes all the way down there. And we're sitting, talking, and I can't speak anybody's language except English at that point. And so we're getting an interpreter, and it's the young boy. And all the time I'm watching and listening, up in the corner, in the roof, a bunch of sticks with leather thongs on them. And I'm thinking, this is weird. So I finally give up. "Can you tell me what the leather sticks are? I mean, the leather thongs on the sticks are about." An old grandma, who's 174 and looks 300, just wrinkly. Oh, I'd love to have a picture of her. She was gorgeous. She said, "That's the most important thing in this house, sir." "I don't know." She said, "Every time a child is born in this house, we take the serving spoon that we're using to stir the pot, we break off the handle, and we tie the umbilical cord around the handle, and we stick it in the roof, because this is safe for that child forever. This is home. No matter what they do, no matter who they become, no matter what they do, they can always come home here and be totally safe. That's where they come from." Is that beautiful? So every time I think of Ellen White writing, I got to quote Jesus. "Father, I would that they would be one like we are one. You and me and I and you. Them and us. For when we are one, the world will know you have sent me." Now that little story of safety is what happens within the word one. In El Shaddai, where the feminine nature of God is best explored, I don't think anybody in town knows what it means. Still, I go there. We're going to build a Maranatha church. But when I get there, I discover there's all kinds of problems with this church. And there's a story. And so I go back and I start tracing the story. And to get to the story, I've got to go to the guy who lives on the corner across from the vacant lot where we're building the church. And the vacant lot has a big chain link fence around it. It's an ugly lot. My lands. It's just rocks and junk and it's just awful. So I go over to Joel Vasquez. Joel Vasquez is an auto mechanic. And Joel Vasquez is the champion Fiat speed racer in Chile. And if you don't think Fiats race fast, you ought to see his Fiat. It has a Corvette engine in it. It's the funniest car. And the only way to do that, you got to, you know, Fiats, they've got engines in the back. And so he switched everything around and he's got this pile of cement bricks in the back because that's the only way the thing will go. Long story. What is this? This is 2012, right? 8 years ago, Joel had a dream in the middle of the night. "Joel? Joel Vasquez. Joel." He's not Joel, he's Joel. "Joel Vasquez. See? I have a job for you." "You have a job? Who are you?" "I have a job for you." "Yes. Who is it? What is it?"
You know that vacant lot across from your house? See? I am going to build a church on it. It will be my true church. I want you to guard it for me. Thank you. Goodbye. I mean, it's like that. And he poked his wife, Trinidad. And he says, Trinidad, he tenido un sueño. And he starts telling about the whole dream. And he gets through all the dream. And she, up on her elbow, and she says, Joel, that's stupid. It's an ugly lot. No God would ever want it. Besides, we're not interested in that kind of stuff. If I ever hear you talk about it again, I will divorce you. Now go back to sleep.
End of conversation. So Joel forgets about it, sort of, for 2 years. And then the dream comes again. Joel, see? You know that vacant lot? See? I'm going to build my church on it.
No! See?
And I want you to protect it for me because it will be God's true church.
Sí, pero señor, mi esposa, Trinidad.
Goodbye.
Trinidad.
Yeah.
I had the dream again. If you ever say anything about that again, I will divorce you. Don't even bring it. Okay.
Where are we now? 206, 208. I need to get this sort of logical.
It's about a year later. Joel is on a seminar with auto mechanics, and he's down in Argentina going to this and learning how to put this together with that. And he's busy in the group, and the guy who's making the presentation, you know, with the 4,000 slides and everything, is in the midst of his presentation. All of a sudden, he stops. Joel doesn't know anybody. He's just him. And the guy says, I don't know why I'm doing this. I've never done anything else like this in my life, but last night I had a dream. And is there a Joel Vasquez here? No, I just got to ask. Is there anybody here named Joel Vasquez? Are you from Chile? See? I don't know why I'm doing this, but in the middle of the night, God told me that you better take care of that vacant lot across from your house because he's going to build a church on it and it's going to be his true church. Now, let me talk about the carburetor. And Joel didn't hear another thing all week. He just was completely blown away. He gets home, and he says, do I talk to Trinidad or do I not? No, I don't. And so he goes downtown, finds out who the dueño of the property is, goes to him, bargains it away, and finally puts part of his house up to be able to buy this land, just a little bit, and to get a... And he puts a chain-link fence around it with a sign saying, sold. He didn't put church coming. She would have divorced him. A few weeks later, Nelson has a dream in the middle of the night. On the other side of El Shaddai, on the other side of Chian, 2.5 hours away driving from El Shaddai. Nelson, see, I need you to go to El Shaddai and hold a series of evangelistic meetings. Pero señor, El Shaddai is muy distant. I can't go over there 2.5 hours every day. That would be impossible. Nelson, si, señor, I will go. And he taps his wife on the shoulder and says, God has just asked us to go to El Shaddai and do an evangelistic series. And she says, we can't do that because if we do that, we're going to lose our job. You know, we've got this thing we're doing. You're doing computer repair. When you're not here, we don't get business. And even though we've got two boys working for us, they're not as smart as you are. They need you around. You can't. And she gives it all the reasons. And then he said, but God asked, okay, let's do it. Every time we've had a request like this, God has provided for us. Vamos. It's an adventure. So the next day he drives to El Shaddai, rents a vacant lot down the road from Joel, not across the street, that one's sold, and starts an evangelistic campaign. As part of the evangelistic campaign one day, he is nailing up one of the, this is before the first one, and he's nailing up the announcements that say, Campaña viene mañana! And as he nails it, the tree that he's nailing it on falls over into a guy's yard. And
Poor Nelson. He runs over into the yard and begins to apologize. There's 42 dogs in this house. They're all barking and trying to eat him alive. And the guy who owns the house comes out in a wheelchair. It's Jose. And he's heard about Jose. Jose is the Joe Crotchety of El Shaddai. He does not know anything about the Great Breasted One. He just wants to hit you and shout at you and be angry because he is not able to walk anymore. And he just hates everybody, including his dogs and his wife. Kick! If he could. Which he can't. And so he curses up and down at Nelson. Nelson explains, and Jose tells him to get off his property. And as he goes off, Nelson says, we're going to do some meetings here tomorrow. Would you like to come? You didn't want to hear the answer. So they have the meetings the next day. Of course, Jose does not come. Joel does not come. Trinidad does not come. They don't even want to be part of this. The next night, as they get ready to start the meeting, Jose moves his wheelchair into the little tent. And Nelson says, well, Jose, what are you doing here? Your music is so loud, I wanted to see the faces because I have to hear it anyway. Six weeks later is Jose's baptism. And Jose says, I want to be baptized in the river. ¿Por qué en el río? Because if we get baptized in the river, I want you to roll me down into the river in my wheelchair, and then I will walk out. And Nelson says, okay, God, I think I need some help. So Sabbath morning, they go down to the river. They push Nelson into the river. The local pastor from Chillán comes in. They take Nelson and just tip his wheelchair over. Because he's not going to need it anymore, right? And Nelson walks out on his own power. Out of the river. Pushing his wheelchair. One day we were walking together in El Shaddai. And Nelson's pushing his wheelchair. And then we go out to their little park. And I sit down on a little bench. And he moves his wheelchair and sits down in it. And I said, I thought you didn't want to ever be in your wheelchair anymore. And he says, oh, no. God gave me a portable chair. It's the best in town. And so he pushes his wheelchair everywhere. After the series, there were 22 Seventh-day Adventists in El Shaddai. They met in a little community center for about 3 months, and then they decided they needed a church. So they started looking around for a church. And one day, Nelson and Jose decided to go up and knock on Joel's door. Knock, knock, knock. Joel. Morning. Hi, Jose. And you, sir? My name is Nelson. Joel and I are... We did this little meeting over here for God. Yeah, I listened to you some nights. It's kind of pretty. We're looking for a place to put a church. And we're Seventh-day Adventists, and... do you know anything about the land, the vacant lot across the street from you? And Joel said, do you believe in Jesus? I think that is the most wonderful question anyone can ask a Seventh-day Adventist. Do you believe in Jesus? I love Nelson's answer. Not only do we believe in Jesus, he is God's son. He created the world. He is the Jehovah of the Old Testament. He is the Jesus of the New Testament. And he is our brother Savior who is coming soon to take us home where he's making rooms for us in his house. Yes, we believe. And Joel said, I'd like to know more. Could you come in and give me and explain what you believe? And so he said, Trinidad! And Trinidad, these men are here. They want to study the Bible with us and teach us about Jesus. And they've asked if they could build, if we know anything about the vacant lot. And they want to build God's true church. Those were words Nelson used. On the lot. And Trinidad said, sobre mi cuerpo muerto. That's over my dead body. And yours. And so she slammed the door and went into the kitchen. And Joel and Jose and Nelson started Bible studies that lasted about 4 weeks.
all the time. Trinidad is in the kitchen,
listening through the keyhole.
So I come back. It's about, you know, there's lots of wild moments in here. The reason I tell you the story is that when I returned, the first volunteer group has been to El Shaddai. There are going to be two. We're building a red brick church. The steel is up. Concrete's down. We've got the bricks almost to the top. And we've got the baptistry finished. And I'm standing by the baptistry. And there are three people with me. Jose, with a big smile. I need to get that right. He's just changed. A completely different personality. It's as if God just took him and turned him upside down. And all of the frowns became smiles. He's just an amazing guy. His wife says, I love him. Thank you. And Joel, who spent the morning showing me how to race a Fiat. And Trinidad. And I said, Trinidad, what does this baptistry mean to you? And she said, Pastor Dick, este bautizario, this baptistry, is for me like the door to heaven. Already three of my family have been baptized as Seventh-day Adventists. But as soon as the church is finished, Joel and I are going to be baptized together here. And we hope all 21 of our family members will be baptized with us. This is the doorway to heaven. God is so good. I wish that you would be one. The thing that happened that made all this work is Nelson and his wife constantly willing to say yes to anything God asked him to do. But God was very specific in working with Nelson. Nelson's a guy who has just crazy interaction with God. And when he goes over, he's not afraid to talk to anybody. And the people consistently ask Nelson, so do you guys believe in Jesus? And he says, that's all we believe. Because when you believe in Jesus, you are, what's the word I'm going to use? One with God. The second piece that she quotes, almost, not as much, but there, is Matthew chapter 5. Now, in Matthew chapter 5 is the Beatitudes. And so I'm just going to whip to Matthew chapter 5 here for a second in the Message Bible. And I'm going to read you the Message Bible version of Matthew 5, 13 and 14. Jesus' words. Let me tell you why you're here. You're here to be salt seasoning, bringing out the God flavors in the world. Do you like that? It's just beautiful. And then he says, oh, and here's another way to put it. You're here to be light, bringing out the God colors in the world. I never really understood the salt and light thing until I read the Message. And when I read the Message, all of a sudden it made sense. My job is that wherever I go, people can almost taste God. And wherever I go, they start to see God's colors in the world. Remember that picture I showed you, that I gave you? If you look at the darkest place and find color in it, everything else bursts into light. That's what God asks us to do. It doesn't matter what goes on in the world around us. He says, be light. We're going to transform this thing into something really beautiful. Now, it's interesting because you can only do that if you become one. If I get up in the morning and say, I'm going to be salt for God today. I go out and I am salt without flavor. And according to Jesus himself, and if the salt has lost its saltiness, it is only worthy of being trampled underground. Now that's pretty specific. And if I try and do salt and light stuff without being one with God, I create darkness and bad taste. Think about that. What motivates everything you do? If it's oneness, then kind of automatically you start doing the salt and light thing because God's in you, and everywhere you go, you just kind of scatter salt and light because God's in you doing it. If you go out and say, I am going to be light, I am going to be salt today, you're going to get stomped on because you're scattering dark. Remember the old
Peanut strip, there was a character in it called Pigpen. Yeah? And everywhere Pigpen went, he left a dust cloud. That's what we do if we be Christians without Jesus. But if we be Christians because he is inside, we're spreading the flavors of God and the colors of God everywhere we go. The third text that she quotes, I want to read to you from Desire of Ages because it's quite amazing, but it's true. If you haven't found Ellen White Light, you're going to want to do that. Desire of Ages, chapter 70, first paragraph. The chapter is called Unto the Least of These My Brethren, based on Matthew 25, the parable of the sheep and the goats. This chapter is based on Matthew 25. When the Son of Man shall come in his glory, and all the holy angels with him, then he shall sit upon the throne of his glory, and before him shall be gathered all nations, and he shall separate them one from another. What do we call this?
Judgment.
Judgment, right? This is the dividing point in eternity. This is where God lets us know for sure which side we're on, I guess. You know, it's an interesting conundrum to put this with all of the other pictures of judgment, but this is real. And then she stops quoting. You know the story. The shepherd looks down and he says, sheep, goat, sheep, goat. And the sheep are the ones who get in and the goats are the ones who get out. I don't know what he has against goats, but that's the way that is. Let me read her next line. And this is where I want to end tonight. Thus Christ on the Mount of Olives pictured to his disciples the scene of the great judgment day. And he represented its decision as turning upon one point. When the nations are gathered before him, there will be but two classes. And their eternal destiny will be determined by what they have done or neglected to do for him in the person of the poor and suffering. It doesn't say, did you worship on Saturday? It doesn't say, did you know that when you die, you're dead? Doesn't say, have you gotten all your sins cared for so that God can accept you at judgment? No, it says, how did you care for all those people? And if you remember the parable, Jesus says that as soon as he separates them, the sheep say, excuse us, why are we sheep over here? And he says, oh, it was because when I came to you and you saw me naked, you put clothes on me. When I was in prison, you came and visited me. When I was sick, you healed me. When I was hungry, you fed me. And they say, why did we do that? They're surprised. And he said, well, you did it whenever you saw need and did it with me. And then the goats say, but wait a minute. Wait a minute. we did that stuff too. And he said, yeah, you did. But you never did it for me. You did it for you. When you saw somebody sick, yeah, you healed them. When you saw them hungry, you fed them. But you never did it with me. You did it for you, trying to look good or something. I don't know. But I was never part of what you did. Those are Ellen White's three main points from the words of Christ. If you and I heal people because without God, we want to heal people, it's useless. It's goaty. If we, you see what I could do? Anything you could add there is real. Ellen White says by these three priorities, number one, most important of all, Father, I would they could be one as we are one. You and me and you, them and us. For then God will know that you sent me. It's interesting that our acts make people believe in Jesus. Because our acts are not our acts. They're what happens when Jesus lives in us. Grace is God getting inside and transforming us from the inside out, not the outside in. Goats do it from the outside in. Sheep let God do it from the inside out. That's what I've learned about God through a really interesting process in the last 2 years. And it's one of the most, for me, graphic ways of saying, not I, but Christ, in every way exalted,
not I but Christ in every word and deed. And it also says, how am I spending my time? What's most important to me? How fast can I tell you who Katie's dating today on cover of what magazine, or what's going on with the Desperate Housewives of Prescott? Or Lake Havasu City. When all God wants me to know is, what's it like to be one? And then I'll know what to do with the people who hurt in Prescott.